And this is The Science Show, starting our 35th year next week. We're 34 on Sunday week. We'll grow up one day. But we're not as old as a fossil of your ancestor I want you to meet next. She's been around for a while, but you may have heard the news last week from La Trobe University and Arizona State about fire, cooking and eating, and in even more recent times, using fire to make tools. Well, the team in Phoenix is actually trying to analyse the engineering of eating itself from the scaffolding and shape of the skull. Here's Mark Spencer.
Well, the fossil that we have based most of our reconstruction on was originally put in a new genus, Plesianthropus, and so our modern-day nickname for it is Mrs. Ples. And it's about 2.5 to 3 million years old. It is a fairly complete fossil. It only lacks the dentition.
When was it found and how?
It was found in the 1940s, 1947, I believe, by Dr. Robert Broom, who was a colleague of Raymond Dart's, who in the 1920s found the first fossil that belongs to this species and named it Australopithecus africanus. That's the species that we now put it in.
Raymond Dart from Adelaide.
Yes.
Okay, so you say that you've got the skull and just a few teeth missing. What do you need to do to get a fairly good picture of how it ate its dinner?
Ah, well, that is a great question. There are a lot of fossils from this species and from other species of early humans, hominins, and the tools that we use primarily for reconstructing diet in them have been to look at the shape of their teeth, which we know from looking at living species is pretty well related to the kinds of foods that they eat. Carnivores have, you know, shearing carnassials, and leaf eaters have long shearing crests on their teeth, and fruit eaters have low rounded cusps on their teeth. We can look at the specific shape of the teeth and get some idea about diet. We can also look at microscopic wear patterns on those teeth using an electron microscope to look at the kinds of scratches that were left, and those are produced during feeding, not usually by the food, but during the process of feeding, scratches are left on teeth. And so a lot of the work on the diet of early humans has been based on that. But at a broader level, many of them have a skull that is very oddly shaped and appears to be specialized compared to other apes and to living humans for the consumption of some sort of food that would have been fairly demanding in the how you would need to process it. So those are the main lines of evidence that have been used for all early hominin fossils.
In fact, we could not have coped with the food that they ate, could we?
Very likely not. They had very powerful chewing muscles and much more substantial jaws that were much more robust than ours. The bone was a lot thicker. And one of the characteristics of early hominins that is very distinctive is that they had very thick enamel on their teeth, which made their teeth very resistant to being worn down and also probably to being broken.
Indeed, if you wear down teeth like elephants do, then you can't eat anymore and you die.
That's right, yes. And you do see some teeth that are very heavily worn in some fossil hominid skulls.
How are you taking it one step further and looking at the engineering and the energy systems and the pressures and the power systems in the skull itself?
Yes, well, our team, and we have a large collaborative team that have brought together lots of types of evidence, ultimately focused on the creation of a model using fairly sophisticated computer techniques, which takes a very complex structure and breaks it down into a lot of small little elements, sort of like Legos, but many hundreds of thousands of those. And you can apply a load to this three-dimensional model that you have in the computer, simulating perhaps something chewing, and it will make a prediction of the kinds of stresses that would have been produced in that structure, in this case, the skull and face of a 2.5 million-year-old hominin. So that's something that's very exciting. This is the first model of such an early hominin that has been constructed using this. And our team brings together people that do the modeling, collect experimental data on how the chewing muscles are acting, and actually you can measure the stresses in the face of a living animal using an instrument called a strain gauge. And we use those data to validate our computer model. Data on the exact anatomy and physiology of the muscles, which are, of course, generating the power that's used to process food. And people who are specialists in reconstructing fossil materials using the computer. We take computed tomography scans of these fossils, just like doctors use to look at your head when you're in a car crash, and use those same techniques to reconstruct a three-dimensional model. We apply the forces that we've spent a lot of effort learning what they are. And we also have somebody who looks at the very specific material properties of the bone itself and how that is distributed, because that will influence how the model responds as well. So it takes a lot of people, and these are all approaches that have been used in a more narrow sense to try to understand the mechanics of feeding over the past decades. One of the advantages of our approach is that it brings all of these sources of data together and allows us for the first time to feel like we have a real sense of what the mechanics of feeding were in a creature that's long gone.
And the wonderful thing about that is that not only do you get a picture of how it lived, what it ate and so on, but also if you're spinning the clock forward to ourselves, we've got far smaller skulls and indeed jaws, which are conveniently freed up for things like talking. Are you getting a complete picture like that?
Not yet. This is the first, as I say, model of any kind of a fossil hominin. And what our analysis is showing us is that there have been a lot of hypotheses about the kinds of things that early hominins ate, and most of them focus on some sort of a tough kind of a food that would have taken a lot of processing. Usually, though, some sort of small, hard kinds of seeds or material that you would have to eat a lot of, poor quality foods. And what our analysis does is really it tests a hypothesis that was presented back in the 1980s, indicating that there's a particular feature in this hominid called an anterior pillar. It's this strut of bone on either side of the nose that had been suggested to be very good for resisting the kinds of stresses that occur in your face when you're chewing on your premolars, your bicuspids, the teeth right behind your canines. And our study tends to support that. And these early hominids were probably cracking open some sort of larger size, very tough kinds of seeds, along the lines of us cracking open an almond or something even harder on our teeth. And that's a kind of behavior that modern humans don't do. We don't need to because we have tools. And so you mentioned the very slender, gracile face of a modern human. That may be because we have tools and have had tools for quite some time that allow us to process the kinds of very resistant things that these early hominins were having to use their jaws for.
And what do you think about the invention of cooking when fire came, say, 1.5 million years ago? When you've got food that's softer and you've got a greater variety because you can soften it through the heating process, that really would have revolutionized not only life, but skulls as well.
Oh, yes, very much. And many of the hypotheses about the fact that our skulls are more slender than the early hominins have related to that. Not only the use of tools for processing our food, but fire among those, because fire certainly does soften food and it makes a greater variety of foods available to us than you would have without that. So undoubtedly it's important, but it's difficult to know exactly how that factors in because the timing of the development of fire is not well established. The use of fire for cooking is not very well established. It's undoubtedly, though, an important development.
So important that fire and cooking allowed us to come out of the trees where we used to hide at night and then use fire to keep the killers away and grow big brains and stand upright. Richard Wrangham has a new book about all that. I was talking to Mark Spencer, an assistant professor at Arizona State University in Phoenix. And so to an intriguing story next week from India. Have you ever wondered what happens to snake charmers when they lose their jobs? And tell me, how did your relationship with snakes begin?
Long before I turned to journalism, I had, just very close to where I live, there's a huge colony of snake charmers. These are people who traditionally follow a profession where they use snakes to earn a living. And I just started by visiting these people. I was just fascinated by the fact that this is a profession not all of us follow. And I was also very interested in, my background was in wildlife conservation. But I wanted to know, how is this community surviving in post-independence India, where there's a law which doesn't allow the use of wild animals? So there's a clear dichotomy between the old and the modern, the traditional, and, you know, all the changes that are happening in India today. So it just started as a curiosity.
Did they welcome you? Were they friendly?
Nope, not at all. They were very unfriendly. It's a male-dominated profession, and the fact that here was this woman walking in asking them all these questions about their profession, it's also a very scared community. These are people who've had raids conducted against them by animal activists, by the forest department, which enforces wildlife conservation laws in India. So they're extremely suspicious of outsiders. So when I used to first go, I remember they'd put snakes in my bag to drive me away. So,
what did you do?
I was scared. I was very scared. And, you know, they defanged the snakes. I didn't know that. So as far as I was concerned, here was a bunch of venomous snakes in my bag. So,
but without teeth, you were safe?
Yes, I was safe. Yeah, I didn't know that at that time. That was the only problem. And so I worked with these people for 7 years. And I have to say, I learned a lot. I was all of 24, 25 when I started out, and gradually I started going out into the interiors, into villages. This is a community which is spread across northern India. There are 200,000 of them. So what is the future of this community if there's a law, you know, banning their traditional occupation? That's what I was trying to find out.
Did they tell you any of their secrets, how they charm the snakes and what it's for?
Yes, they did. They have many secrets which they don't let outsiders in on. But I also wanted to document their traditional knowledge, because there's this sort of preconceived notion that because they're an indigenous community, they don't know much science. But what we've actually found was that there is a lot of science they follow. And I used to go with them on their, when they used to go out to hunt the snakes. And if for every species, they look into the behavior of that species. They know what is the micro habitat in which that species is found.
How Bahar Dutt helped save the snake charmers and avoided getting fanged in the process. She's from Uttar Pradesh. The Science Show next week. On Catalyst, now beyond their teenage years, you can see the Eureka Prizes next Thursday at 8 o'clock in the evening on ABC TV One. Production today by David Fisher and Charlie McCune. I'm Robin Williams.